The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, hello, and welcome again to a Beatles talk show that we call Things We Said Today. This is a weekly podcast in which we talk about all things Beatles, any part of their past, their present. Basically, any topic is up for grabs here on this show. I'm Ken Michaels. I'm one of the regular co-hosts of this program, also known for my other Beatles program, a syndicated show called Every Little Thing, being joined by two of my regular co-hosts. Sal Sussman couldn't make it for the show this time out, but he will be joining us in our next program. So with me on the program this time is the man who writes for Beatles Examiner and many Examiner columns, that being Steve Marinucci. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ken. Hello, everyone.
And our musicologist and freelance writer, also a writer for Beatle Fan, as is Al Sussman, that being Alan Kozin. Hi, Alan.
Hey, Ken. Hey, Steve. And hello, everyone.
This time out, we're going to talk about the Beatles Live at the Star Club tapes. And it's a very interesting topic to bring up because I really love to listen to these recordings now. I know when they first came out, there was a big controversy around them because the sound quality isn't that great and the Beatles tried to prevent it from coming out. I thought we'd talk a little bit about the history of these recordings. And also talk about the music itself, the recordings, what we all think about it. And first of all, I want to just ask the two of you, when was the first time we ever heard about these recordings? When did that come to light publicly? Do you either of you know?
I think probably the first time was at a Beatlefest in the mid-70s, mid to early 70s. Alan Williams was traveling around with a tape of excerpts and was giving sort of talks about these recordings and playing tantalizing samples, one of which, I think a recording from part of his talk of a bit of My Girl is Red Hot, I think, turned up on a Melvin bootleg. And others turned up when someone apparently got their hands on Alan Williams's excerpt tape and put that out. But we didn't really hear, most people probably didn't hear about them until 1977 when they were semi-officially released on a couple of labels, Belafon in Germany and Lingasong in the U.S. As a two-album set, two LP set.
Yeah, I remember hearing that at Joe Pope's Beatle convention.
Mm-hmm.
It was either in 73 or 74. That's when Alan Williams brought the tapes over. And they were played directly from the reel-to-reel.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be mentioned that those two albums were different. They weren't the same. They had different tracks on them. It seems to me, I believe one of the differences was Where Have You Been All My Life. I think that was on one and not the other. But your point about My Girl is Red Hot, Alan, I remember hearing that first on that news show, and I can't remember the name of it now, that did little minute excerpts. You know the one
Days in the Lives?
No. This was a in fact, the entire series has circulated, and I remember hearing Red Hot there first.
Uh-huh.
And it was only it was only like 10 or 15 seconds of it, because and that's all you heard. And but I could be wrong. You might have the time right on that, but I remember hearing about it. I don't remember exactly how. I didn't hear it at a Beatle convention, but I remember, you know, the scuttlebutt. Maybe there might have actually been news reports about it at the time.
Uh-huh.
And I remember you know, looking for them. I remember, you know, walking through a shopping center in San Jose looking for the different versions, and I found them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't particularly care for them at the beginning because the sound quality was so bad. It's only later that I really came to appreciate them more. And I think they're really fantastic. And it's, not to skip too far ahead, but it's curious to me how they don't embrace this, and they did embrace those Quarrymen tapes on the anthology. That's strange, because those tapes on the anthology are really dreadful. I mean, if you think the Star Club tapes are bad, these are much worse, you know. But I like the Star Club tapes, and you know what people have done with them. We can go through some of the history of that, but you know, there's been some nice upgrades. I don't understand why they didn't you know, take more kindly to them. Maybe they weren't getting any money off of them, or I mean, you know.
Well, they
whatever.
Could have, of course. They could have. Right. Alan Williams offered to sell them the tape in 1973, and they could have had it in their vaults and done what they wanted with it. I think it's an emotional issue, really. You know, those early tapes that were on the anthology from the they weren't really the Quarrymen. They were actually practicing pre-Hamburg, I think, in the spring of 60. But I think it's kind of clear that those are an unpolished young band practicing, whereas these are the Hamburg tapes, where, you know, they were already the Beatles as we know them pretty much. They had already
right.
recorded Love Me Do, and I guess they wanted them to be at a higher standard than they felt they were, whereas the practice tapes are just practice tapes, and they only gave us a few minutes of them.
Mm-hmm.
The Hamburg tapes that they stopped in court were, you know, was really a double album set that purported to show them playing as they would normally in Hamburg. And I say purported because it doesn't, it doesn't. You know, should I elaborate?
Sure. You're gonna, I wish you would. I mean, we know they've been jerked around, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been bootleg releases, but even more recently, you know, there have been other things that have gone on. Go ahead and talk about that.
Okay, so, you know, the raw tape was recorded over a few nights while they were playing at the end of 1962, and it captures them as a bar band, which is fundamentally what they were. You don't get a lot of applause between songs, and you don't, you know, it's not polished, and there's a lot of chat in between the songs, some of which is, you know, fairly rude, and some of it is funny, some of it is sort of a bit of banter between them on stage or between them and someone in the audience. And it's very loose, but the sound isn't really that bad. What happened in between those tapes and what we heard in 1977 is someone acquired the tape from Alan Williams, and an engineer named Larry Grossberg made detailed notes about what was on the tape and did what I believe was really a well-intentioned attempt to make the tape sound better. How did he do that? Well, he actually wrote a piece in High Fidelity magazine describing what he did. And basically he took this mono tape and he put it onto a multi-track tape, doing different EQs for each track so that he could, he hoped, bring out the guitar, bring out the bass, you know, bring out each channel. He would try and bring out something else, and then he attempted to make a mix. In addition, I guess he felt that, you know, if this is supposed to be a Beatles live tape, we can't have a lot of this dead air in between the songs. We have to have applause, and we have to have, you know, not necessarily screaming in the 1964 Hollywood Bowl sense, but we have to have some audience reaction, you know. And there was some in some parts of the tape, and he used that, and I don't know if he enhanced it in other ways, but he sort of added that between all the songs, and that in a certain way kind of falsifies the experience of the tape, because when you listen to the raw tape, it's not there. Mm-hmm. He also edited out a lot of the comments and talking and things. He left in enough to capture the flavor, I think, but a lot of that's gone. False starts are gone. I think there are some performances that are edited, you know, bum notes taken out, things like that. And he put this out as an album. And the problem is that whole EQ thing, while theoretically not necessarily a bad idea, in practice, it just made the tape sound a lot muddier than the original tape. Now, the original tape has made its way out in various forms over the years, especially recently. Maybe an hour or a little more than an hour has come to light that I believe was probably taken from a tape that goes back to 1973 that had been copied for Apple. How that got out, I can't really say, but it's the purest version of this recording that we have. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wonder, since Apple had custody of this tape or a copy of it, whether when George Harrison went to court in, I think it was, what, 92, was it?
Was it in 1977?
Yeah, they actually sued twice. They first sued in 1977, and they did not prevail, partly because the judge seems to have misinterpreted a comment that Neil Aspinall made about John Lennon telling Williams or Ted Taylor that he could do what he wanted with the tape. Aspinall was actually saying this should not be construed as permission to put the tape out. The judge heard it differently and felt that, okay, if John gave Taylor permission to do what he wanted with the tape, then there's no case here. So Apple lost the first case. They then went back in 1998, it was, when Sony put out its two individual CDs of the Star Club material. And since Sony is a much bigger target, I guess, than Lingasong or the Belafon and the other small labels that have put it out until then, I guess they felt it was worth their while to revisit the subject. So they went to court and they brought out more big guns, including George Harrison, who in his testimony said something to the effect of, you know, one drunk recording a bunch of another drunks doesn't make a recording session.
I'm looking at your story right now, Alan. And the exact quote says, "One drunken person recording another bunch of drunks does not constitute a business deal."
Right. So when you say my story, is this, you were saying that something of mine that I wrote in 1989 was quoted someplace? Is that what you're?
I'm looking at that. It's 1998. No, it's 1998. Right. You posted this on Rec Music Beatles.
I see. Okay. Many years ago.
Many years ago. Would you agree, I recently, and I didn't unfortunately get to write this up, there was the recent auction of the quote-unquote master tapes.
Right.
And Ted Taylor said that they were not the master tapes.
It actually was always advertised as a safety copy, not as the original. It was Larry Grossberg, actually, who was auctioning the tape, and it was his pre-EQ copy that he was selling. And I have to say, I'm a little surprised that it didn't sell, although I think maybe they expected too much money for it, because that is the version of the tape that you want. You know, it's the purest version. It also establishes what the actual running order of the songs was, which is something nobody has yet figured out. We may find out soon, actually, because Hans Olaf Gottfredson, who has written a lot about the Hamburg era, he's written a large book about it. I think, what was it called, From the Cavern to the Star Club, or I can't remember.
Right.
It's right behind me. But he's interviewed Larry Grossberg, and Larry Grossberg sent him a copy of his notes from the tape box all those years ago. And I believe he has an article coming out in Record Collector this month or next month in which he discusses what was on Grossberg's notes. I don't think he got to listen to the tape, but Grossberg's notes should establish the actual running order. And Hans Olav told me that so far, everybody who has tried to reconstruct the original running order on bootlegs or in books, including himself, had it wrong. So that will be an interesting article to see, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, there's a new package of these recordings that just came out, but there was an adjustment made to the sound quality.
Right. This is a package called Zulaut, and there were a few things done. The person who compiled it, who is a very fastidious sound guy, first of all, went out of his way to get the best possible sources, meaning not using the Lingasong versions, the versions that Grossberg prepared for release wherever possible, but using that hour-long tape that I mentioned a few minutes ago, using, I believe he had a tape source for the Beatles versus the Third Reich, which was one of the albums made from Williams's tapes back when he was lecturing on them, and some other things. And the other thing he did is, I mean, he didn't want to overdo it on the EQ, but he experimented with a stereo expander, a plug-in of some kind. I'm not sure who makes it or which one. And he had done it originally just as an experiment, because that kind of thing gets pretty widely criticized when it's done. But what he found was that doing that actually seemed to bring out certain of the instruments more clearly than just the straight mono tape. And so when he decided to put this package out as a free fan production, it's not a for sale bootleg, and he released it various places on the internet, he decided to use the stereo, the mock stereo version. And I have to say, it doesn't sound bad. We're not talking about Dave Dexterized, you know, fake stereo with a millisecond delay between channels and lots of reverb. It actually sounds really good. And I think I hear what he means about hearing some of the rhythm guitar texture and things like that.
I think you have to say, at least in my feeling, is that overall, though, it's not a huge improvement over what you already know for the sound quality of that set. Would you agree? I mean, it may improve some of the instruments, but it doesn't improve the tape itself.
Well, right. I mean, it's still an amateur recording,
right,
from a single suspended mic in a club in Hamburg while people are talking and drinking and, you know, and the Beatles are playing. That's true, but it doesn't have all of those EQ problems that the Lingasong version had, and it also presents the tape as much as possible the way it exists in its raw form. There's lots of talking and dead air in between the songs, and it gives, I think, a much more realistic idea of what that experience might have been like, you know, just hearing them in that situation.
There's also a lot of, I was listening to it this afternoon, there's some new bits and chatter in there that have not been heard before. So there's there's stuff that you haven't heard. We didn't mention that we kind of skipped over the Ox Tango release.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really good. You know, as far as improving the overall sound quality, I thought the Ox Tango package did a great job. Unfortunately, it appears that that's not going to be something that you can get anymore, mm-hmm. unless you get a copy of it from somebody who already has it.
Right.
The last couple times I've checked the website, you know, they still have the notices that they're still trying to get things together. And that's, you know, you can take that for what it is, because the Beatles have apparently gone after them. So,
right.
Yeah. But I mean, I thought Ox Tango did a great job with those tapes. It really did. Do you guys agree as far as that goes?
What I heard from Ox Tango sounded brighter and punchier,
mm-hmm.
Especially Red Hot. that one in particular. I do like the new one that came out. It's a different sound. It sounds kind of fatter and mm-hmm. wider. But then again, you have to question how much can you do with a mono recording. I mean, the main problem that anyone can have with this recording, and it's not a problem for me anymore, because you have to realize what it is. This sounds like if you were in the back of the Star Club, this is what the band sounded like. Mm-hmm. The mix itself, you hear the guitars really well. You can hear the drumming pretty well. The only thing that you have a problem with are the vocals. You can hear them, but they're more distant. So you can't possibly adjust that to make the vocals stronger or level with the guitars and drums. It's always going to be that way throughout. So if mm-hmm. you can live with that, it's still a fascinating recording to listen to in terms of listening to their playing. I mean, this is all we got, let's face it, from the days in Hamburg. This is the only live recording that's ever surfaced. I think that we should treasure it for certain reasons. But I also know that it's a pretty rough listen for people who are used to, you know, perfect studio recordings, you know.
I think the one thing about it is there are moments on it. I wouldn't say the whole tape is superb as, you know, with their performance, but there are some great moments on that tape. I mean, it's hard to imagine why George Harrison was so down on that recording. Uh-huh. It does nothing to damage their reputation. If anything, it only enhances it. I mean, you could compare that. I mean, everybody loves, obviously, the Hollywood Bowl stuff. But for raw energy, the Hollywood Bowl is nothing next to this, you know.
Plus, this is the only live tape we have of them, with the exception of some of the BBC things where they were in a studio and had some options. This is the only live recording we have of them without screaming all over it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here they are playing an awful lot of stuff, including a lot of the songs that were otherwise available only on the BBC recordings.
Right.
Playing them live in a room for people. I mean, that's as authentic as you can get for how they were at that period right before they catapulted into, as Candy Leonard might say, Beatleness.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, they had a single out. They had a second one recorded, but, Love Me Do got up to number 17. They weren't yet what we sort of knew and what we know them as now. And here they are just, playing, letting it rip. And, I think it's not a perfect performance. There are some stray notes here and there, particularly, and maybe this is why George was particularly against it. I mean, some of the lead guitar solos are a little probably experimental and things work and don't work, or go astray. But, it kind of shows them working as a live band. It's not, you get two takes of the song and they're not the same, when they played live on the live recordings, we know they tend to be very close to the record. You hear them trying things. I mean, for instance, I saw her standing there. There are a couple of different takes of it and Paul phrases it differently, So it's kind of, if you're a student of the band, as you might put it, and you want to know how they did things and how the process, in which the songs as we know them from the studio recordings evolved, this is an incredible tape to hear.
Mm-hmm. Now, the only other early recordings we have are that Some Other Guy mm-hmm. in Kansas City from the Cavern, mm-hmm. and also that one little rehearsal, and I can't...
The Cavern rehearsal, yeah.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. one. Those are the only other pre-Beatlemania tapes that we have outside of the BBC things.
Mm-hmm.
And but you're right, this is unique in that nobody is, the Cavern rehearsal doesn't have any screaming on it either, actually. But
there's
this
no
is
audience, it's just them.
Right. But this is much better because there's more energy, because you've got people yelling in the background and it's the atmosphere of Hamburg is there, and that was unique unto itself. So
I find these recordings to be very fascinating now. once you, you know, if you really get into the history of the Beatles and how they evolved and what they were performing at a certain time. I always remember going back to when Mark Lewisohn put out his book, The Beatles Live, which was the first major book that he wrote on the Beatles. And it documented all the songs that they had done live up through 66. But what was really fascinating was the early years and the songs that they covered at that time. And whatever Mark could find, the group performed even just once, was there in the book. And you would have a list of all these song titles with the original artists or the artists who influenced the influential version that the Beatles heard. And, you know, I'd be salivating looking at this list and wishing that I could hear some of these recordings. And this is a good taste of it, live at the Stars Club, because in addition to the songs that the Beatles eventually released that they covered, like Mr. Moonlight or one of those songs, and the songs that they did on BBC Radio, which I treasure, you got a whole bunch of other songs that they never released. So this was all part of their repertoire, you know, knowing the songs that they did live at that time, knowing the songs that they covered, you know, and also I find it interesting the whole process of when they finally had their record contract, what did they decide they would release on EMI Parlophone of the songs that they covered when they had so many of these other songs that they did very well live in concert. You know, part of the reason why they were able to record the Please Please Me album so quickly, 10 of the 14 songs in one day, is because they were songs that they knew so well. You know, many of them were covers that they were doing in concert all the time. So, but there are all these other songs, like the one that you just mentioned, Where Have You Been All My Life? That's one of the real gems that you discover on this collection there. That's an Arthur Alexander song, which, you know, you hear this and you kind of wish, God, I wish there was a better version, you know, or, you know, a BBC version. You know, if you look at the 36 songs the Beatles did on BBC Radio that they never released themselves, that's three albums worth of material that they could have released right there. And those are only those songs. And then you've got all these other songs that they used to do live. So, and they really were, they were both a tight band at the Star Club and they were loose at the same time. But more importantly, they were real and they were human. And like you said, Alan, there are some mistakes there. The very beginning of Roll Over Beethoven, George is making a mistake on the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's left in there. And I find all that fascinating because it's real, you know, but, there's a lot of gems there on these recordings. Especially, you know, Sheila is a nice treat.
Mm-hmm.
The Beatles did the Tommy Rowe song and George sang lead on that. And as we learned from, Mark Lewisohn's book, Brian Epstein, once he became manager, he really wanted George to get more songs to sing. He thought that would make them even more attractive as a band to have three lead vocalists. So, you know, that's something that you notice, especially with the BBC recordings. And then you go to Live at the Star Club and you got a few more songs from George than you normally would get on a studio Beatles album.
But, one thing that should be mentioned about the Zumlaut set is the fact that not all the tracks are the Beatles. They've managed to put out the King Size Taylor set.
Right.
There's nine tracks of King Size Taylor, and one of Cliff Rebel and the Rebel Rousers. And I think the Rebel Rousers had been out. The Hully Gully, I think that's the one that was masqueraded as the Beatles and isn't them. But
right.
The King Size Taylor stuff is brand new. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because I was listening to that. How many of those songs were songs done by the Beatles and how closely the King Size Taylor versions resembled what the Beatles did, and you wonder who got it from who, you know, because the King Size Taylor has Money, it has Dizzy Miss Lizzy, and it has Twist and Shout.
Right.
And the versions, I mean, Twist and Shout especially is a song that you can't do really differently. It's not one of the, you know, that opens itself up to variations, but you wonder who heard it or who heard what, you know. And I'm sure that a lot of that went on in Liverpool too, you know, in the Cavern days with everybody playing the Cavern. But that's interesting. But
also we should mention there's a couple of songs, Bebopalula. It's really Fred Fasher, who is the waiter at the Star Club. He's the one who sang lead on that. Was he Horst Asher's brother?
I believe so.
Yeah, okay.
Good. Alan, what were you going to say?
I wanted to add something to that, you know, because you got the two Fashers here. And also, mm-hmm. Horst Fasher is the one who sang lead on Hallelujah, I Love Her So.
Right.
But the Beatles are backing both of them up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and that's another interesting aspect of you know, they're in a bar, people are coming up and singing with them. And, you know, in Mark's book, he talks about some concerts where people sang with them, too. And that's just kind of fascinating, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I find interesting about this set is that there aren't an awful lot of originals. There's I Saw Her Standing There and Ask Me Why. I think that's it, isn't it? Is there any other Lennon-McCartney thing here? They don't do Love Me Do, which is
right.
You know, currently out as a single. They don't do Please Please Me, which they had recorded about a month before and were going to have to be playing a lot pretty soon. You know, they may have done them other nights than the ones these were recorded. But
right. They also did Matchbox. They did Till There Was You, which is interesting on its own. You know, them doing that in a club like the Star Club, you know, in a place like Hamburg.
Why is that?
Because it's not really a rocker. I mean, I would think that would be strange that they would exhibit that side of themselves in a club like that.
Well, I think it has a certain semi Marlena Dietrich quality, you know.
I didn't think about that. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Like Falling in Love Again as well. I mean, that was one of her songs. So.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think they may have sort of reached back for that side of themselves now and then because to appeal to the, you know, certain part of the audience, drunk and sentimental, let's say. Yeah, but there aren't that many like it. I mean, there's A Taste of Honey as well, but they are mostly rockers and, you know, and some funny things like Your Feet's Too Big and Lend Me Your Comb, you know, those are both there. I mean, those aspects of their act as well is represented. So, yeah.
Yeah, they were also into, I guess you'd want to call it novelty rock. You know,
right.
Like they love the Coasters kind of stuff. So this is similar in that vein.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the Beatles wanted to have that broad appeal, and that's why they did songs like Falling in Love Again or
mm-hmm.
Till There Was You. And they also did Over the Rainbow.
Right.
Live. But from what I understand, the version that they were influenced by was Gene Vincent's version, although the whole world knows Judy Garland doing it.
Right.
But they were probably more influenced by the rock versions. And in the same way, Till There Was You, they were influenced by Peggy Lee's version as opposed to the soundtrack of The Music Man.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I think is really interesting here is just some of the songs they really did much faster.
Mm-hmm.
Than the versions that we're used to on the studio recordings. I mean, Roll Over Beethoven is lightning speed, as is Nothing Shaken But the Leaves on the Trees. And it's almost like, you know, if the Ramones could do Roll Over Beethoven, it would be kind of like what the Beatles were
mm-hmm.
doing there.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Moonlight is also much faster.
I'm talking about you. Talking about you also.
Yeah. And especially... They were just so good. I mean, they were good at everything to me, but they were exceptionally great at doing Chuck Berry material. And one of the highlights for me, apart from I'm Talking About You, which I always loved the BBC recording, but Little Queenie.
Oh, yeah. And
that really mm-hmm. rocks. And it's nice to see Paul do the lead vocal on a Chuck Berry song, which he did there. So, you know, there's so many great Chuck Berry songs. Sweet Little 16, they did fantastic. The BBC recording of that is really phenomenal. It's one of my favorite of the BBC recordings. But, you know, you can tell how they were just so, you know, natural at doing Chuck Berry stuff, you know, no matter who sang lead.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And also some other highlights I wrote down here. Well, you mentioned Lend Me Your Comb. I really love that version. Reminiscing. Is really
mm-hmm.
interesting. You know, it's George singing lead there for a Buddy Holly song. I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Cry Over You. Another one which was phenomenal as a BBC recording. And I Wish I Could Shimmy Like My Sister Kate.
mm-hmm.
What'd you think of that? That was
That's
an Olympic
great.
Song. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Red Hot. Red Hot is pretty hot too.
Yeah.
With an organ part.
Except that organ part, as I recall, is not them.
It's Larry Young.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
From one of the other
but
groups.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that is a great version. Overall though, the question of, you know, whether they were wrong to reject this the way they did, I think that was a mistake. Getting back to what we, you know, the topic we had a couple of weeks ago about mistakes. I mean, this is a great set, and you know, I hope at some point somebody in the Beatles, you know, in the Beatles family decides that, you know, this deserves to, you know, not to be shoveled away under a, you know, under a box and actually give it a decent release.
Well, it's a never-ending debate. You know, we all want the Beatles to think the way the fans do. And they just don't. You know, they're very sensitive to their own works. And as I've said on this show a number of times, you know, often the Beatles themselves have referred to, or at least Paul has said it, and I think Ringo has said it, like the Beatles anthology material is scraping the bottom of the barrel. You know, to us, it's fascinating. I don't know about the average person, but, you know, to me, anything that's unreleased and anything that shows the development of a song and the changes that are being made and how the Beatles evolved, you know, as a band and with their music, to me, I find fascinating. You know, but we expect them to think the way that we do. And, you know, there's a lot of artists out there that don't mind releasing a lot of their unreleased stuff. The Beatles are not that way. And, you know, it's pretty miraculous that we got the Beatles anthology material. So, we wish that they would see things the way that we do. And certainly in terms of historical perspective, this stuff is really important.
We could go into a whole thing about the worth of the anthology recordings, because I think that was really a letdown, an incredible letdown. I mean, it's nice that we got some of those unreleased things, but the way it was handled and the way it was done was pretty bad. I mean, there was a lot of Alan. You probably know better than I do, but there was a lot of messing around, and they held. There were delays, and I think they actually reprinted. They had a finished version, and they called it back because I actually saw the booklet for it, and then I think that was number 3 actually that they called back. And it was, I mean, that was crazy stuff. I mean, that shouldn't have happened. Shouldn't have happened like that, especially for a project like that.
I remember them calling back number 2 because something was taken out of chronological order. Is that the one?
Okay, I can't remember.
Yeah, I think they just wanted it restored to chronological order, or vice versa. Maybe it had been in chronological order and they thought that something would be better at the top. Yeah, it wasn't like, I don't think it was to change anything or delete anything. I think it was just a positioning question.
Okay.
I like the anthology, you know, it's, I understand what you're saying. I mean, things were definitely edited and tinkered with, but I think, you can have expected them to do that because, as Ken said, they're very sensitive about their work. You know, I actually, in one of the interviews I did with Paul McCartney, he talked about this whole question of unreleased stuff, and it was before the anthology came out. It was around 1990, and he said, you know, I understand why you find this fascinating. I mean, and he said, I bootleg other people's stuff, which I guess by which he meant he goes to concerts with a tape recorder.
That's a great quote.
He said, but you have to understand that, you know, I'm the guy who, you know, you have what you think is a great photo of, but I look at it and I say, you know, my nose looks too big in that picture. And when it's us doing it, we're just very careful about what gets out there, because we let an unreleased take of, you know, I think we talked at the time about the version of Can't Buy Me Love with the call and response intro, which was not out yet because the anthology wasn't out yet, but it had been bootlegged. And what McCartney said was that if a kid hears, say, the outtake of Can't Buy Me Love on the radio and doesn't know that it's the outtake, he felt that there'd be no way to know what was the finished product and what was the interesting oddity. And I said, well, you know, there'd be liner notes, things like that. It would all be explained. And he said, yeah, but, you know, people don't read the liner notes on the radio. They just play the track. And if you're just coming to the Beatles fresh, and this is the version of Can't Buy Me Love You here, you're going to think that this is the real version. And it's important to us that our finished work be heard. They obviously got over that to put the things out in the anthology, but I think that's also why some of these tracks were edited in ways that you feel they shouldn't have been. I mean, they're kind of making a compromise with us here as fans. They're going to give us something unusual, but they're not going to give us the, you know, bad notes and the, you know, bad ideas, and they're going to put things together. So I think that version of Can't Buy Me Love is edited, and they made a version of One After 909 that brings together several takes, but that's what they would have done if they released that at the time.
Well, it wasn't so much the editing. I mean, the editing, I actually understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the disorganization and the way the, you know, they put out the three separate sets, and there was a long delay between them and all that. And that just didn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
I think going back to that, you know, I mean, it, you know, now it would have been completely different. You know, they would have put out a six CD set, they would have put out vinyl, they would have put out God knows what. I mean, it would have been immense, you know. The one good thing about when it came out is it came out reasonably priced, because if it came out now, it would be incredibly expensive.
Well, right, you know, I mean, even at the time, there were some collector's labels who put out, especially in jazz, you know, who put out 10 disc sets of someone's, you know, mm-hmm. outtakes. And I think the Beatles and EMI were a bit more conservative than that. And they felt that, you know, people will buy a 2-disc set and they may buy another one in 4 months, but they're not going to be happy buying a 6-disc set. And whether they're right or wrong, I mean, you know, I think all of us would have gone bought it no matter how many discs it was. But that was their thinking, I think.
Not only that, but if you release them separately they're months apart, it becomes more of an event each time you do that. So there's more buildup.
Well, especially with the first two, because of Free as a Bird and Real Love. Right. You know, people are anticipating these things.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
But and look what happened though with the bootleg with the iTunes release.
Mm.
People went nuts over that. I mean, they went absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
And the anticipation that there wasn't one last year I still occasionally hear people saying, why didn't they put one out last year? Even though there had been indications, and you probably heard them too, Alan, that they weren't going to do it. You know,
right.
I heard that all year. I didn't really want to believe it, but the indications I kept getting and what I kept, you know, trying to tell people was, you may not get it, and nobody would believe it. And there were even people writing that you would get it. And
mm-hmm.
as it turned out, it didn't happen, you know, and, you know, so that's, you know, I mean, I still would like to see them do it. Maybe they'll reverse course, but, you know, I think they probably set the bar last year. I think that's going to do it for whatever reason. I would love to know, I'll tell you.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're going to do what they want to do when they want to do it, and they're going to take their time. I mean, it would have made sense for 1964, given the hoopla that they tried to avoid because they didn't want people to think it was 50 years. That would have been the time to put out some really deluxe editions of, say, you know, With the Beatles and Please Please Me, with as many outtakes as you could get and, you know, different mixes and things. And and it would have been logical. Any other band would have done it, and they didn't. And, you know, they don't have to. They can do what they want. And I'm hoping that eventually they'll want to. But, you know, there are other projects still clogging up the pipeline that they're
right.
also taking their time with. I mean, way before the anthology was released, they had remastered the Shea Stadium concert for a video disc release, and it
right.
hasn't come out. Same with Let It Be. You
right.
know, Let It Be has been kicking around to Apple for a really long time. I mean, they did interviews with Neil and with everybody mm-hmm. else that are there waiting to be heard, and there's been talk of perhaps offering a different edit that shows them a bit happier, you know, in addition to the regular film. There are all kinds of ideas, and maybe because there are so many ideas, it's getting held up too. But Let It Be had originally been remastered for release before the anthology came out. So they've got these projects. They're just sort of not getting them out there. And when they do, I mean, I can understand what you're saying about the anthology being disappointing, because when they finally put out Let It Be Naked, I was hoping that they would put out one of the Glyn Johns mixes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was too.
Because that, you know, that actually is quite good. I know they didn't like it at the time, or at least Paul didn't like it at the time. I think John did. But, you know, that kind of was the album that Almost was. And mm-hmm. I was kind of disappointed by Let It Be Naked. I reviewed it for the Times at the time, and I think in the end I said it really was Let It Be with a fig leaf.
You know, I kind of felt that way too when it first came out, but I've changed my tune to use a pun because it sounds so damn good. I mean, the sound quality, the remastering on it just sounds so great that it really kind of eased my fears about it. I wish all their albums sounded as nice as that one does.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I agree with you. I wish they had put out the Get Back album. And I also wish they had done a little more with the outtakes that they captured from the bootleggers. I wish they had, you know, not just put that little excerpt on the extra disc, or had done something a little different there, maybe mm-hmm. add a little more to that extra disc. But what can you say?
This is more of a continuation of the Beatles' mistakes.
There we go. We really got off on that.
It's supposed to be about the Star Club here. But.
Right. And it all proceeds from the idea that they made a mistake in not releasing the Star Club tapes officially, which, I really do hope they reconsider, too. Maybe someone should send Danny Harrison a copy of this latest version and see if he thinks better of it than his father did. I doubt he would want to countermand his father's decisions, but still, you know.
Maybe not so soon, but maybe, you know, a few years down the road, he might reconsider that.
Mm-hmm. I remember before we expanded our show to have Alan, we were talking about Danny Harrison and the disappointment that we didn't get more material out of the Apple box, the George mm-hmm. Harrison Apple box, and Danny was saying he wants to take his time with all the early take stuff. He doesn't want to be, again, scraping the bottom of the barrel. So he's going to be respectful of his father's feelings. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is a never-ending issue between the fans who want everything or the best of what's unreleased and the Beatles and their families and how they're going to handle this.
I think we all understand that, but I think that there's one other point to mention, which is that a lot of us who really want to hear this stuff are people who grew up hearing them, and by the time they release them, the audience is going to be people who first heard about the Beatles when Paul recorded with Kanye, you know what I mean?
Right.
You know, it's like their audience is like, we're getting older.
Well, right. Do you think? Well, this is going to start a whole other conversation. But we can save this for another show. But maybe we should just bring this up: whether or not you think young fans of today can get so passionately interested in the Beatles that they would get interested in all the bootlegs too, you know? Or is that strictly more of a first generation or second generation thing? Do you have to live through it in order to want to get that passionate into everything that they've ever done?
I'm surprised at how, you know, John Wynn, who's put out quite a number of books about their session recordings and et cetera, you know, chronologies that include everything they did, and he's a fantastic researcher. And I mean, I can't remember exactly how old he is, but I was startled to learn how young it is. It's like I think he's in his 30s now.
And is he really?
Yeah, and he's been doing this for quite a while. He may be hurtling towards 40. I don't know. But I remember, you know, years ago hearing how young he was, and I was really astonished. And listen, you know, there are people who get into jazz now and will collect. I mean, who's buying these complete works of Django Reinhardt things? I mean, I don't mm-hmm. hardly any of his audience is alive, if any. You know, those things were recorded in the 40s, and yet you see Mosaic and other jazz labels putting out, you know, 10, 12 disc sets of Django Reinhardt, or, you know, okay, B.B. King, you know, okay, he just died and people, you know, remember a lot of things, but you see, you know, complete works and complete 40s and 50s recordings of B.B. King coming out now, and they were coming out when he was alive. So
I love Reinhardt too. I want to mention that I'm a big fan of Django Reinhardt.
Mm-hmm. Mm. There's a couple things I want to just bring up about the Star Club that we didn't get to. There's a few songs that the Beatles performed that are not complete on these recordings, and I don't know whether that was a case of whether or not the reel-to-reel machine was started late or whether the tapes didn't survive that well, but I Remember You, which is the Frank Ifield song that was a hit in 62. That's not complete, the Beatles' performance of that. And also Nothing Shaken But the Leaves on the Trees is not complete as well. So that's a slight disappointment. It's,
and,
you know,
and Red Hot and Sheila end early. It could be that someone turned the tape recorder off or reel ran out. Yeah.
Alan, you would know this probably better than I would. The Zumlaut recordings are more than one night, is that correct?
Right. It's at least December 25th and December 28th. I think there's been some debate about whether there was New Year's Eve as well. I think the current feeling is that it's not, but because there's the people who speak German have been parsing some of the stuff that's been said that indicates the New Year or New Year's Eve, and are thinking that, you know, it's not said in the way that it would have been if it really was. So, it's at least two nights.
Wouldn't the Beatles have said something on stage about it being New Year's Eve or Happy New Year or anything?
You would think so.
Although, you know, given Lennon, well, I don't know. No, I would. Yeah, I suppose he would. Although, you know, John was so crazy. I mean, as far as, you know, getting up there on stage, and God knows what they might have been on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they may not have been thinking along those lines. But
or the tape recorder could have been off when they said it, if they said it. So.
True, that's true too.
But how do we know it was those two dates? Is it on the tape box?
It may be. I think so. I don't really know.
There's got to be documentation because the New Year's. I mean, I think Ted Taylor has said when it was recorded. So again, he was the one and he would know.
And
so,
I guess I should mention again Hans Olaf Gottfriedson's article due in Record Collector magazine anytime soon. We'll probably get to all those details and the track order.
And that book, his book is fantastic. If you can, I think it's probably if you look it up to try and buy it, it's going to cost you a few bucks, but it's well worth it. Oops.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to repeat something that Alan said before, which I was going to bring up too, which I found rather interesting, in the fact that they didn't do Love Me Do live. When you consider the fact that that was their first official single on a major, you know, record company, you would think that they would be all over that song.
Right.
And even though Please Please Me was recorded in November, they could have played that. I could understand not playing it if it wasn't released, but certainly Love Me Do. I found that a little bit baffling. You know, you're there to promote your work in part. And also, it's just a fascinating time to listen to the Beatles do this because they were on the brink of, you know, world stardom. And, you know, if you were to compare January 1st of 62, when they had the Decca audition, when it was a year of uncertainty, and then at the end of the year, it was a year of promise.
Right.
You know, so much happened in 1962, And I know Mark Lewisohn has written that the Beatles didn't want to do this. They didn't want to go back to Hamburg because they had so much going for them at that moment. And I don't know if I detect that in these recordings. I think that they're having a good time. You know,
I also,
yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
I also think that they're not, you know, I don't really think they saw it as promoting time. You know, if they were giving a concert, they'd have played Love Me Do, but because that's to the audience that would go buy the record. But I think when they were in Hamburg, they were like in a different mindset. You know, it's like, okay, here we're the band in this place, you know, and I don't think they were thinking promotionally very much.
Right. Right.
And I also think that when you take into account that both John and George have said publicly that they were at their best as a live band when they were in Hamburg,
mm-hmm.
for that reason alone, even though these are not great sounding recordings, they should be released for that reason. I think the Beatles were such a good band live that they could have done a lot of these songs in their sleep because, you know, they did 8 hours a night minus the breaks, but still, you add that up night after night, and you can tell how good they were at these songs, that they could just wing it, you know? And I love hearing a lot of especially a lot of George's guitar work here. You know, some of the solos that he did that were a little bit uncharacteristic of him. That if you're so used to the studio recordings that the Beatles made, and here he's much looser, and he's doing a lot of the 50s rock and roll and early 60s rock and roll that they loved. And, you know, he's cutting it loose a little bit, and I enjoy hearing that in particular. So it's a lot of reasons to enjoy this collection. You were talking before about them being rockers mainly, and they also did To Know Her Is to Love Her.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, another ballad there. So, you know, for the most part, rockers. But and that's one of my all-time favorite BBC recordings right there.
Mm-hmm.
So they did mix it up a bit.
I was looking at Spencer Leeds' book, The Beatles in Hamburg, and he makes a point of which drummer played the most on stage with the Beatles. Was it Ringo or Pete Best? And the Ted Taylor tapes have Ringo on them, but it was Pete Best who played with them in Hamburg more, which is kind of an interesting. No, I know he was with them at the time. I'm just saying that in all the Hamburg gigs, Pete Best was the one, you know, that they played with more.
Hmm.
So,
interesting to hear some of those.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It would be. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like we have any, but yeah. So.
But also, before we found out that this was done at the end of 1962, when we knew for a fact that Ringo was in the band, didn't Alan Williams or maybe Taylor, King Size Taylor, didn't they want to try to make it seem like it was when Pete was in the band? Because that way, then EMI wouldn't have the rights to these recordings, and they couldn't protest it, or the Beatles couldn't protest it. Wasn't there a period there when they were trying to establish these recordings maybe as being pre-Ringo?
I don't remember that. Do you, Alan?
I seem to remember hearing about that.
I don't remember that either.
Well, I know there was the whole rumble about whether or not they were signed to EMI at the time, and I think it had more to do with the date they were recorded, I think, Alan.
And that's pretty clear.
Right.
I think, you know, Ken, maybe what you're thinking of is you may remember, I mean, only a few years after these came out, there was a sort of gray market version or several versions of the Decca audition tape that Pete Best was actually promoting. I mean, they made mm-hmm. picture discs with Pete Best's, you know, picture on it, and
right,
he
I
gave
have
interviews.
It.
Yeah, so maybe you're thinking of that or something.
No, I thought that maybe this was done deliberately so that EMI couldn't contest these coming out. If they could say, if they could prove, or if they could say Pete Best was the drummer, then mm-hmm. you knew that was done before the Beatles had a record contract.
Right. Yeah, they may have tried to obscure that when the Lingasong version came out in 77. I don't remember. I'd have to pull the disc out and see if it says Ringo, or haven't looked lately. Hmm. Mainly been listening to the online versions, you know.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right, so that puts this show to a close. This has been great talking about the Star Club, although we did quite a lot about the Beatles.
A few other things.
But that's just to tease everybody for future shows that we're going to do. That's why we did that. It was all done deliberately, folks. So if any of you would like to, and we make it to sound so smooth that you wouldn't even know it, but believe me, it's all done deliberately, right?
Absolutely.
If any of you would like to write to us, we have an email address here, which is thingswesaidtodayradioshow@gmail.com. We also have a Facebook page for our show called Things We Said Today. Each of us has our own Facebook page. Mine is under Ken Michaels. Alan has a couple, actually.
Two of them. Yeah, Alan Kozin and Alan Kozin Remixed.
And Steve has about 3,000 of them.
Something
but,
like that.
You could just mention a couple.
Well, I have the one, my personal one, and I have a Beatle News one, Beatle News and Commentary. And then, of course, we have Facebook pages for the radio show, too. So we're there.
And Al Sussman can be found on Facebook.
And Al Sussman's definitely on Facebook.
Okay. And also, I just want to make a quick mention of my website, KenMichaelsRadio.com. There's a brand new interview on my website that I just did with Gary Burr, who many of you will know for all of his work with Ringo. He was a member of the Roundheads. He started work with Ringo on the Ringo Rama album, and he's still working with him today, even on the new album on Postcards from Paradise. There's a song that they wrote together, Touch and Go. And it's all about, working with Ringo and his whole history in the country and pop field. He's had an incredible career as a songwriter. He's like a brill building writer in a way. and I think you'll find this conversation very fascinating. It's on my website, KenMichaelsRadio.com. All right? So, thanks so much for joining us. And for Things We Said Today, I'm Ken Michaels, being joined by Steve Marinucci and Alan Kozin, saying thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.